Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
As Governor Brown kept his promise, a budget with no gimmicks. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Governor Brown has signed a state spending plan he calls honest but painful, full of cuts to core functions of government, balanced on revenues that may never come through. Will the Amazon tax push companies that sell on the Internet out of state? Can redevelopment agencies legally be abolished so the state can take all their money? Are the rich really making that much more than expected? Also tonight, the man who flew from New York to Los Angeles on an expired boarding pass in somebody else's name. Later on, playing chicken with the U.S. economy. First, here's the news. Warman Alney back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. Despite public outrage, Greece has agreed to spending cuts and tax increases, although even those measures might not keep the country from going bankrupt. If the U.S. doesn't bite a similar bullet, will its full faith and credit be suspect in the eyes of the world? More on that later. First, a Nigerian man named Olajide Noibi got through the TSA checks in New York, flew Virgin Airlines on an expired boarding pass in somebody else's name, and arrived in Los Angeles. He was arrested trying to fly to Atlanta. Andrew Blackstein is covering the story for the LA Times. Andrew, good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren.
Is the TSA explaining this?
Well, I think it's difficult to explain. Obviously, there's a number of different points at which they could have snagged this passenger and failed to do so. One of the things that the airline came out with a statement is that they might have missed an alert in New York, but certainly there's problems all the way through. He gets through a TSA checkpoint, and although there's no weapons, the question is, was there an effort, or what happened when they were trying to match up his ticket with a valid form of identification? In this case, he had presented a University of Michigan identification and a police report that said his passport had been stolen.
His passport had been stolen. What about the fact that the name on the boarding pass wasn't his and it was a day old?
Well, that's the thing. This isn't discovered until mid-flight. It actually is kind of by happenstance where a couple of passengers complain of a foul odor coming from a passenger. Then when the flight attendant goes to check, lo and behold, it doesn't match up. Now, that's something that should have been done on the ground, where not only it's done going through the before the checkpoint, usually somebody's looking at your ticket and looking at a driver's license or other form of valid identification as according to the TSA's own rules, but also oftentimes you will be there at the gate and somebody will also kind of try to check and see if this is a valid boarding pass, in which case this was a day old, and so this is another point it was missed. And then back on the ground in L.A., now he's gone for several days, returns to the airport Tuesday night, goes through security screening again, apparently with the same kind of set of circumstances, spends time in the terminal before Wednesday morning he tries to board a Delta flight, and this time the gate agent notices that there's problems. Now, I mean, that's a lot of potential points at which he could have been snagged and didn't happen.
Well, now, that first when they noticed him on the first time, though, that was on the Virgin Airlines flight. They realized he had somebody else's boarding pass, but they didn't stop him there. They let him off the plane when the plane landed, right?
There's an interview that takes place with federal agents on the ground. The way it's been described to me by people familiar with the situation is that they did a criminal background check, they interviewed him, and did a cursory search of his carry-on bag, which happened to be a kind of a store bag with items in it, and deemed him to be not a threat, and he was let go. Now, what's interesting is we learn when there's a search the second time when he shows up Tuesday, or tries to get on a flight Wednesday, I should say, they find these phony boarding passes. And that's, again, how he was monitored, how thoroughly was he checked? I mean, certainly what federal authorities are saying is, look, there was no weapons, there was no problem there. He passed that screening. But I think it calls into question some of the communication or lack thereof that's going on between the airlines, TSA officials, and federal law enforcement.
And you would think, too, if Virgin Airlines had turned him in, they might want to have wanted to approach him about paying for the ticket.
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's the thing. It's not the most serious breach that we've seen over the years, but it certainly calls into question again that, you know, that all these things have been put into place since 9/11. What kind of communication is going on? And, you know, obviously one of the things, the common refrain is, well, there's tremendous amount of people that go through, and we also see stories about people, the most recent one, a 95-year-old woman who was thoroughly checked, and I use the word loosely because it was, you know, obviously caused a lot of outrage. And then you have a situation like this where somebody kind of slips through, isn't checked on a kind of a basic level. And
it, so, the 95-year-old woman, as I understand it, had an adult diaper, and they made her take it off.
Right, and I think that's the kind of thing that sparks outrage. You look at a case like this and you say, well, there wasn't fundamental checks done on identification, and here's a woman that is older and shouldn't be subject to this kind of grueling screening. So you definitely have a gap there in the mind of the public about what really is going on, what should be going on.
And not serious in the sense that he didn't have anything, any explosives on him, or try to do anything while he was on the plane. Apparently he slept through much of the flight. Nonetheless, he got on, he got off.
That's right. And then tried to get back on again and got into the airport and was right there at the gate. And I think that's the question. I mean, obviously in federal court he's being charged as a stowaway, but it's a close call kind of issue that makes people, it gives them pause.
Okay, Andrew Blankstein, good as always to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Warren.
Andrew covers law enforcement and the courts for the Los Angeles Times. We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way L.A. or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. As a share of the state's economy, Governor Brown says, the $86 billion state budget he signed today is lower than any since 1973. There are massive cuts in core services. But Republicans refuse to extend tax increases, and the deficit still required $12 billion in new revenues to be balanced, as the Constitution requires. $4 billion of those new revenues are based on projections that wealthy taxpayers are doing better than anybody expected. Will that money really materialize? Christopher Thornburg is the principal at Beacon Economics, based in Los Angeles. Always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
How do you answer that question?
Well, the answer is no. The money won't arrive unless, of course, we do in fact get the sales tax increase, if indeed that goes to the voters and the voters vote yes. When you look at the numbers that they came out with in this budget, what they have more or less done is budgeted in the revenues they would have gotten with the extension of the sales tax increases, almost assuming that those are going to be there anyway.
They insist, though, that because of the revenue that has already come into the state, they've gotten much more than they anticipated in January. So they're assuming that still more will come in as the budget here goes on. You don't buy that.
No, not at all. If you look at the January budget, it was pretty clear by the numbers that were coming in and the growth in the economy and what had been happening in stock markets that the January forecast was a low ball. It's pretty clear that that number was put up by the Department of Finance in large part to give Jerry Brown some negotiation room. However, when the May numbers came out, they reflected what was actually going on. And in fact, the forecast for next year looks pretty much dead on from our perspective. So therefore, they really can't realistically hope for this unexpected $4 billion to come in.
I suppose we should be shocked that the Department of Finance would adjust the estimates in order to help the governor.
Well, again, they work for the governor. Ultimately, he has to approve or not approve stuff. So,
Christopher Thornburg again is at Beacon Economics, based in Los Angeles. Still more of that new revenue projected for next year comes from the so-called use taxes that the state hopes to collect on Internet sales from companies like Amazon. Right now, those taxes depend on consumers, few of whom ever report what they buy online. Declan McCullough is chief reporter, political correspondent, and senior writer at CNET.com. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, a pleasure.
This gets a little bit complicated, but tell us exactly how the state hopes to get more revenue by getting Amazon and others to become its tax collector.
Well, you're exactly right. The state is taking kind of a two-pronged approach. It's belt and suspenders. First, it's saying that if you have subsidiaries in California, then you have to collect taxes on shipments from Amazon or Washington State to California, and Amazon has two, A9, which does search technology in Palo Alto, and Lab 126 in Cupertino that design the Kindle. And the second approach is that it says if you have affiliates in the state of California, you got to cough up taxes to the tax collector, and Amazon has plenty of those. California is not the first state to go after affiliates. It's about the sixth or seventh. And in every state that has threatened to rely on the presence of affiliates to collect sales taxes, Amazon has cut them off. It's happened in New York and New Hampshire, Connecticut. So that's not new, and it's not surprising that Amazon would do that. The subsidiary thing, that connection is new, however.
What's the difference between an affiliate and a subsidiary?
Well, a subsidiary is a wholly owned company, in this case, A9 and Lab 126. And an affiliate is, think of it this way, you live in California and you're into gardening, you run a garden blog. And to make money from this, advertising may not pay the bills, so instead you have links to Amazon. You can buy native wildflower seeds, Big Sur-styled wildflower seeds, and if someone clicks on the link, buys it from Amazon, you get a small percentage of the transaction, and over time those small percentages can add up. And so that's Amazon's affiliate program. It's a very good one, and Amazon has now killed this. So all these small businesses in California, and there are over 10,000 of them, what are they going to do? In other states, it's too early to say in California, this just happened yesterday, but in other states what's happened is that they find a more hospitable climate. I mean, if you're running a business from your home, and some of them are, then you could move across the border to Nevada and have a cheaper cost of living, and your affiliate program works again.
What about the subsidiaries, wholly owned subsidiaries? Are they likely to move out of state as well?
Well, these are really small companies. A9 and Lab 126, they've got 100, 200 employees apiece. So one option that Amazon has is just to move jobs from California, which, by the way, costs California tax collectors' revenue. So that's not, it's kind of really counterintuitive, or it's unintended consequences. The other option is that Amazon says, okay, bring it on. And they haven't elaborated when I've been trying to get them to talk to me about their legal strategy here. But in 1994, a California appeals court rejected a similar claim from the State Board of Equalization, saying, no, a subsidiary is not the same as a parent company. If they keep everything separate, and Amazon does, then one can't be responsible for the taxes of the other. So I think Amazon is going to rely on that and say, sure, you can try, but I think this law is unconstitutional.
Declan McCullough, once again, at CNET.com. Christopher Thornburg, back to you at Beacon Economics. Mr. McCullough calls this unintended consequence, but the name of Amazon does appear many times in the budget bill, so the legislators certainly knew what they were doing. Do you agree that we're liable to lose businesses from California as a result?
We may lose some. Probably won't be catastrophic, but it will obviously be an issue. And, of course, various states are going to keep turning on Amazon. But really, this brings to light, I think, a much deeper issue. The state has always relied on sales taxes on a small group of goods, physical products, the kind of things that you can easily buy from, say, Amazon.com. Then, of course, if you go to a place like Texas, interestingly enough, while we always talk about Texas being so tax-friendly, actually, Texas has a much broader sales tax. That sales tax dips into quite a few services and online things that helps them raise considerably more revenues than ours does. And ultimately, goods, as part of share of people's budgets, are declining. What this means really is that we should stop thinking about trying to get back at Amazon.com and really consider how to fundamentally change the sales tax system overall and have, say, a lot more services included in that tax base. Ultimately, you could raise more money and not have to deal with these sort of issues.
Declan McCullough, this would appear to be something that might work a real change for consumers in California.
Right. I mean, think of this in perspective, or let's put this in perspective. California is not alone in this. There are plenty of states, it's getting close to a majority, that are trying to simplify things and their sales tax structure, and then they hope that they can persuade Congress to alter federal law to require Amazon to collect taxes, even though Amazon isn't a California company. So this is not a new effort to collect taxes, but it's almost like this effort in the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. hasn't been successful so far, so state legislators are getting kind of desperate. They're looking for anything, and they're trying these new approaches, even if they may not be quite legal.
It may cost them a lot of money to defend this effort in court, I would think.
I think that's probably an understatement because Amazon has not blinked. I mean, this is kind of a staring competition to see if one side or the other is going to back down, but they haven't. They're litigating in New York right now. They litigated when one of the Carolina states tried to go after them for customer records over taxes last year, and they won. So this is a company that, like Walmart, plays hardball, and in Walmart's case, as we saw from the Supreme Court in the last week or so, it pays off.
Have to tell our listeners, KCRW uses Amazon for CDs. It's a very successful way to move goods, and we're part of the action in that sense. Another device for balancing this year's state budget is dismantling local redevelopment agencies and taking their money. But those agencies claim that is illegal because of Proposition 22, approved by the voters last November. John Howard is editor of Capital Weekly. And John, thanks a lot for being with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about Proposition 22. I understand that the redevelopment agencies want to go direct to the state Supreme Court in order to fight this one.
They do. They feel that if they go to the state Supreme Court, rather than going to the superior courts that they've done twice in the past, they can get a faster hearing, expedite the case, and maybe get a favorable ruling on their side.
How much money are we talking about here with the redevelopment agencies?
Well, the budget that Brown is going to be signing has $1.7 billion in redevelopment money. They get about $5 billion a year they collect in property taxes, but much of that money is encumbered. Much of it's committed to other projects. But the $1.7 billion is the first-year take for the state. After that, it's about $400 million a year. What the new budget would do, it's a two-step plan. It would first abolish the agencies as they exist now. And then the second step is to allow agencies that want to go back into existence if they fork over money for education and some other programs. And there's a complicated formula that's been set forth how that would be done. What I understand, talking to the League of Cities yesterday, they said that they had heard after they posed a questionnaire to their members, about 50 of their redevelopment agencies had said they could not stay in existence in any way if they were forced to do the kind of spending that the state would require to keep them in existence. So in effect, what's going on is the redevelopment agencies will be abolished absent some legal opinion.
And what about Proposition 22?
Well, the proposition, you know, that's a sort of a term of art. The language seems pretty clear. There is specific language in there that the state cannot use money that's set aside for redevelopment projects for anything else but redevelopment. The issue is whether the two-step, the two-bill package that the governor has signed gets around Proposition 22 because it abolishes the redevelopment agencies as such. That's the first step. Therefore, if they're abolished, if they don't exist, does the language in Prop 22 apply to them? That's one issue. Another issue is what the voters have done once they might be able to undo later. Perhaps the administration might want to go back to the ballot on this issue if the courts rule against them. Perhaps the courts will weigh in and rule in their favor. A lot of things are in flux right now.
John Howard with Capital Weekly. Come back to you in a moment. First, back to Christopher Thornburg again at Economics. The governor said that he wouldn't sign a budget that had gimmicks in it. He said today it was an honest budget, although it is a painful. Does it meet the test, as far as you're concerned, of honesty and not having a gimmick?
No, obviously not. There's a lot of things that are clearly up in the air. I mean, the redevelopment agency's issue is still very much in flux. I agree with what we just said. And again, those $4 billion in revenues, they will arrive if, in fact, he manages to get the income tax and sales tax extensions put on the ballot, and those are indeed extended. We'll get some of that $4 billion. But that again, is very uncertain. Probabilistically, what chance will be on the ballot and what chances are that the voters will pass it? That sort of uncertainty is not what you would call a credible budget.
Apparently, that wouldn't even happen until the November election of next year, and the fiscal year would end before that. So things might be pretty uncertain up until that point. John Howard, back to you with Capital Weekly. What's the likelihood in Sacramento now, or what are people thinking about the likelihood of having to go back and revisit the budget early next year?
You know, I think people are all over the map on this. My personal opinion is that the $4 billion will show up. I was just talking to a guy today who follows us very closely. He thought it would be Tier 2, that some of the money would show up, but not all of it, and some cuts would be triggered. I guess it's all a question of how the economy bounces back, if at all. I tend to be more of an optimist than a pessimist, even with sneaky budgets and smoke and mirrors budgets, which I kind of like because they're fun to cover and they make good reading. But I think I think money will be there, and I think we're actually, I think we're going to get through this. I think for me personally, the larger question, and politically, the larger question is what happens with the elections next year. I think it'll be very interesting to see whether the legislature, both houses of the legislature, come up with Democratic majorities, two-thirds Democratic majorities in both houses, and they can pass budgets, tax budgets, if they wish, and do it on their own with no Republican input at all, which would really be a sea change.
Assuming that Christopher Thornburg's right and the money doesn't show up, you're right to point out that there are triggers. There already are an enormous number of cuts. The governor said today that compared to the budget, the economy as a whole, this is the lowest budget since 1972 or 73. What more cuts would be triggered if the money didn't show up? What happens first?
Well, I know they've talked up here about education. Even though it appears that education is protected now, there are ancillary programs that could be cut. Certainly social services could be cut. Welfare could be cut. Those are the first ones to go in any tight year. There already have been cuts. Medi-Cal reimbursements could be cut further. They're never protected in the way people think they might be protected. If the money's not there, there'd be quite a fight over those.
Back to Christopher Thornburg. There has been, of course, this dispute about extending what were supposed to be temporary tax increases in sales, as you mentioned, also in income, and on the vehicle license fee as well. They will expire or are expiring today. Will that be a test of the Republican claim that if taxes go down, then the economy goes up?
Yeah. Well, you know, that claim that somehow or other the decline in taxes is really going to make that much of a difference to the economy is just false, to be perfectly honest with you. Instead, they've drawn this partisan line in the sand, both at the state and national level, that from my perspective really makes very little sense. At this point in time, to continue to dig that much deeper into the state budget is, it's getting to be unconscionable, to be perfectly honest with you. Obviously, health and human services need that funding for all those folks who are still out of work and having a tough time getting a job. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, I realize that people are like, why aren't we out of this mess? But you got to keep in mind, we didn't put in real solutions over the last couple of years. Instead, the fiscal can just got kicked down the road. And as a result of that, this is really built up. We're going to have to pay these higher taxes for a couple of years to fully dig out of this hole. We should be willing to do so.
John Howard, you said the budget may be better than it looks. What about the motivating force of the fact that because of Proposition 25 of last year, when they passed a budget that was judged by the state controller not to be balanced, the legislators' salaries came to a halt. Now that the governor has signed what's referred to now as a balanced budget, they come back and they start getting paid again. How much of a difference do you think that made?
You know, I think it made a lot of difference, although I'm amazed that it did, because when Prop 25 was approved, at the time, the conventional wisdom was it didn't make much difference. It really wouldn't make much difference. It seemed to be sort of the frosting on the cake of other items on the budget, on the ballot that were rejected, and Prop 25 didn't seem to be that significant. And yet, as it turned out, I think that it was significant. Maybe there are more legislators, just like more folks everywhere, that live paycheck to paycheck, and it did make a difference in terms of pressure on them and meeting a deadline. I thought it was sort of amazing that they actually they got it out on time. Of course, now the veto and the subsequent decision by John Chung, the controller, to dock their pay, that decision was really pretty amazing. The veto was unprecedented as far as I know, and the decision by the controller not to pay legislators because he had made a value judgment that the budget was bad was really sort of I think one of the most amazing decisions I've ever seen up here. He does not have the authority to do that, as far as I can tell, in any objective sense. He did it. It was politically smart. He's very, very smart and very adept. He knew he would not be challenged on it in any meaningful way, and he has not been, although a few Republicans have asked the Attorney General to look at it. I think it was an amazing decision. He hasn't done it on the budget that was just passed, and certainly this budget, as Christopher mentioned, there is smoke and mirrors in this budget too. It was an amazing decision, and I think it's one that, if it's a precedent, it would be something that people in both houses of the legislature and the governor would have to watch.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. John Howard, editor of Capital Weekly, Christopher Thornburg at Deakin Economics, and Declan McCullough, chief political correspondent at CNET.com. Good to have you all on our program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, playing chicken with the U.S. economy on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. After yesterday's riots over austerity measures, Athens was quiet today as the Greek parliament put the final touches on spending cuts and tax increases designed to unlock $17 billion in aid from the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Nick Malkoutsis is deputy editor of the English edition of the Greek newspaper Katamarani. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
How difficult was this for the Greek government, particularly given the kinds of outside activity we saw in Athens?
It's been a tough few days. I think the Greek government has been in for a rough ride since it took power in November 2009, and the last couple of days were very, very intense. I think what you saw on the streets, and perhaps it's a slightly distorted image that goes around the world, although I think it was a fair reflection of the fear, the concern, the angst and frustration and anger that exists in Greek society at the moment. But it's anger primarily directed at the Greek political system as a whole rather than the government. The measures are through, though, and now the really tough part begins, because this government has to implement them to regain trust with the European Union and the IMF.
What do you mean there's frustration with the system as a whole?
Well, there's frustration with where Greece has ended up. I think what people are angry about is that they feel that the political system, albeit the one that they have voted for over the last three or four decades, has let them down. They feel that the politicians didn't govern in the interests of the country, that they let the economy go to waste, that they didn't make the most of EU funds over the last 30 years, and that they allowed they basically were in it for themselves, that they were corrupt, that they didn't represent the people, and this is the result of, and this is why we are where we are at the moment.
Now back to implementation. How deep are the cuts? How high are the taxes? Who's hit hardest?
Well, the hardest hit are the middle and working classes, and this is part of the problem, because the government has really come down heavy on them because they are the easiest people to tax. Greece has a problem with tax evasion, as it is quite well known now, and those tend to be the groups, the self-employed, who are the dentists, the doctors, the architects, and so on, who declare their own income, whereas the civil servants, the employees in private companies are all taxed at source, so they're very easy targets.
When you say that they're angry at their own government, how do they feel about those international organizations that they now depend on, the European Union, the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund?
Well, I would say that opinion is split, and it's split because there is, I would say, perhaps the majority, perhaps just under 50% of Greeks who feel that the future of the country very much lies within the European Union and within the Eurozone. And they want this crisis to get through this crisis with the help of the European Union and to come out the other side as a sort of modern, efficient European country. There are those that look at the bailout and say that this isn't helping Greece, this isn't helping Greeks. It's propping up European banks, it's propping up, it's preventing a wider crisis in the global economy, especially in the financial sector, and the price is being paid by working class and middle class Greeks, and they don't like it. And they attach a lot of the blame to the EU and to the IMF, although it's quite interesting that within the EU, we don't see the EU blamed as a union as such, but countries within the EU, particularly Germany, come in for a lot of criticism, and I think that's as a result of a lot of the things that are said and written in Germany, which Greeks are finding insulting.
Nick Makoutsis, once again, deputy editor of the English edition of Katamerani in Greece. Zanni Minton-Bedos is economics editor for The Economist magazine. It's good to have you back on our program.
It's great to be here.
Are the Greeks justified in being angry, especially at the German banks?
Well, I think Nick put it extremely well. The middle-class Greeks are justified in being angry. They're justified in being angry at their political class for, if you will, wasting the years of membership of the European Union and indeed membership of the Euro, because the origin of this problem that Greece finds it in is sort of twofold. They have a huge debt problem. They owe much more than they can possibly pay, and that's because they spent a decade, basically, spending much more than they took in tax revenues, and because investors thought that Greek debt was pretty much as safe as German debt. And they've now woken up to the fact that it isn't, and Greece suddenly has a huge debt problem. And then the second problem is that Greece's economy is completely uncompetitive. It is in a single currency with countries like Germany. Its workers can't compete with more efficient Germans, and to become more competitive, countries traditionally have one route, which is a quick route to deal with that, which is to devalue your currency. Well, you can't devalue your currency if you don't have a currency. And so they have a painful route of cutting costs, increasing productivity, and it's going to be a very, very painful process. And I think it's true that at the end of it, if they get through it, the Greek economy will be, a much more efficient economy. But doing the things they need to do to improve their competitiveness is hard enough. Doing it with a debt burden that is actually, I think, unpayable is virtually impossible.
What do you mean by unpayable?
I just don't think they're going to be able to pay the amount of debt they owe. And I think that what this current, package of new lending from the European Union and the IMF does is a sort of band-aid. It kicks the can down the road a bit, but it doesn't solve the basic problem, which is that Greece owes more money than it can possibly pay. And at some point, there will either have to be a real restructuring of debt that involves a real reduction in the debt burden, or it will be owed to official creditors like the Europeans and the International Monetary Fund, and it will be sort of implicitly reduced because it'll be very, very, very long maturities and they won't actually ever really repay it.
Which is the best alternative?
Well, it depends on how well it's organized. I think much better than what they're doing right now would have been a restructuring that involved a real debt reduction now, that involved a real debt reduction for the private creditors too. But the worry that the Europeans have about that, there's a big worry that if you have anything that smacks of a real debt restructuring, that it would hurt European banks and could cause a kind of catastrophic contagion effect. They don't believe it could be orderly, and therefore they've chosen this other route, which is to kick the can down the road.
Well, when you say there's a real debt reduction, and it sounds to me like you're suggesting that when you say the debt load they have now is unpayable, there's no alternative.
I think there will be, in the end, a debt restructuring or some kind of a reduction of the debt burden. I don't think we haven't seen the end of this movie. This is this passing of this austerity package by the Greek Parliament, the probable release of more funds from the Europeans at the meeting later this weekend, buys a few weeks, it buys a few months, but we are going to be back in pretty much exactly the same situation, I think.
Zanni Minton-Bedos, economics editor for The Economist magazine. Jacob Kierkegaard is economist and research fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Mr. Kierkegaard, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here.
Tell us, if you will, is the U.S. at risk because of what's happening with regard to Greece and the EU?
I don't think the U.S. is at a sort of a serious immediate risk because the exposure of U.S. banks and financial institutions directly to Greek government debt and Greek banks in the forms of various credit default swaps and the like and the derivatives is actually quite limited. And that's true also if you look at the numbers for money market and mutual funds and the like. So as long as this situation is contained to Greece or even if you contain it to the three countries, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, I don't see any particular risk for the U.S. It's only once you have the contagion effect that Zanny was talking about through the general European banking system, banks in France, Germany, and then if you have country contagion to Spain, that's when the exposure and the direct risks for the U.S. financial systems begin to pile up.
Let's go back to Zanny Minton-Beddoes. How likely do you think that's to happen, that is to happen, the contagion effect that would go all the way to Spain?
And I think it depends on how competently or incompetently European politicians handle this. I don't think there needs to be that kind of contagion effect. A comparison is often made with the aftermath of the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in 2008, and there's a lot of talk in Europe that were Greece to default, it would be Europe's Lehman moment. I don't think it needs to be that, because as Jacob pointed out, Greece itself is relatively small fry, and the European banks could actually withstand losses from any Greek default reasonably easily. The danger is if there's a sort of forest fire, if you will, if it goes, if one country goes and then panic spreads to another country and then to another. And I think that whether or not that panic takes place depends on whether financial markets think politicians know what they're doing and have the situation under control. And it's one thing to have an orderly restructuring of debt. It's quite another to have a kind of uncontrolled default where no one quite knows what the policymakers are going to do. And I think if it were the latter, then I would really start worrying. And the problem in the European case is that, you know, in every single instance in this whole ongoing drama, European politicians have left things to the very last minute. They've basically done the minimum amount necessary to put off trouble, but they haven't really got down to solving the problem. And that's what makes me worry more than I otherwise would.
Let me go back to Nick Malkoutsis in Greece. What is the government's position with regard to an orderly restructuring of the debt, or have they got that far? What would that mean, even more tax increases and more spending cuts, or would it simply be a haircut for the Greek creditors?
Well, officially, the government rejects any talk of restructuring, and it does so because that suddenly creates an out for the people from this crisis and something that they would then demand, because a restructuring, at least in terms of the pressure that it would put on the Greek taxpayers, would be much less than the austerity package we're going through at the moment. So the government and, of course, European Union officials have been very, very careful about rejecting this kind of talk. But what we've seen this week is that the French banks and today the German banks are now looking at this scheme of sort of rolling over Greek debt, which would sort of they're trading in Greek bonds and then allowing Greece to repay part of that debt over 30 years, which is a positive for Greece. And I'm sure we'll see more schemes like these, more ideas like these over the months to come, because really what we are doing now is just buying time, both at a domestic level and at a European level, and that time is being paid for by the Greek people, and at some point they're going to stop paying, they're going to refuse to pay anymore, and then you really need to find a viable solution.
So, Zanny Minton-Beddoes, you're right to be worried then. And there's politics in Greece that might militate against an orderly restructuring.
It might. The longer you leave it, the harder it becomes, because the more austerity the Greek people will have gone through to no kind of permanent solution of their problems. And so it seems to me that one difficult balance is, even if there is is a restructuring of the debt. Greece needs a lot of austerity. It needs a huge amount of overhaul in its economy. And so it's restructuring is not a silver bullet. It doesn't mean there's no pain in Athens at all. But so people who sell it as a kind of quick fix solution are misguided. On the other hand, austerity with no restructuring, I think, is also not a solution. And that's kind of what we have right now. So in the end, you have to have both. You have to have the reforms in Greece, and you have to have some solution on the debt. And my worry is that you're going to have one without the other, and that's just not going to work.
Jacob Kierkegaard, is it likely that this will be a problem that's resolved at the very last minute, presuming it's resolved at all?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that is, unfortunately, the case of this crisis in the European Union and the Eurozone. It goes down to the wire every single time. I guess I will disagree a little bit with Sani, the sentiment that European leaders sort of deliberately leave things to the last minute because they're weak and they're, undecisive. I will say that I think it's because many of us probably underestimate the political constraints that are faced by various political leaders.
You said that you thought there were political issues in other Eastern European countries and among the EU, that it wasn't just a weak organization that caused it to sometimes defer important solutions. Elaborate a bit.
Well, I mean, I do believe that it's a weak organization. I think we just need to be a little realistic here in terms of the constraints that are faced by politicians like Angela Merkel and others. I mean, a comparison that I like to make is that imagine in 1977 that it was the National Governors Association that had to bail out New York City rather than the federal government. I mean, I think we can all agree that would have been a rather messy thing as well. But I also would say that, you know, we shouldn't underestimate what has been achieved during this crisis. Because, I mean, if you had asked me 2 years ago whether or not it was conceivable that 90% of German parliamentarians would have voted for a bailout package for Greece that scaled to U.S. Size or U.S. GDP is actually larger than TARP, meaning that a vast majority of the German parliament would have voted for a bailout for another country larger than TARP. I mean, I would have said you were crazy. So I don't think we should just say that just because things are left to the last second in the European Union doesn't mean that things doesn't get done and you actually don't have potentially very far-reaching decisions being made. But it is unfortunately just the nature of these things. Because of the painful political concessions and compromises that needs to be made, that you know, elected political leaders are only able to do that at the very last minute when they have been seen by their constituents, you know, to be fighting to the last, you know, drop of blood, which is unfortunately a political dynamic that, in my opinion, is being played out in Washington as we speak with respect to the debt ceiling. This is just the way these things are done, unfortunately.
I want to get to that in just a moment. Zandi Minton-Biddos, your opportunity to respond. Has a good deal been achieved, particularly when we hear what we did about the German parliament and its willingness to bail out Greece?
Well, clearly the EU has come quite a long way from where it was, you know, a year and a half ago in terms of its, you know, willingness to set up new institutions and things. That said, I guess I disagree with Jacob in that, of course, you know, politicians have to work under political constraints. That's true. And you know, it would be naive to think otherwise. But I think notwithstanding that, there's been a remarkable, you know, inability to come to an agreement before the last minute. But not only that, an inability to do anything beyond the very minimum necessary to put off the problem for, you know, a week, a month, 3 months. And there are sort of really big contradictions in the European approach. The main one, I think, is an absolute unwillingness by the Europeans to countenance any restructuring of Greek debt, but at the same time, an unwillingness to really continue bailing out Greece. And so I think that those two are ultimately contradictory. And there are fundamental tensions in the EU's approach. And that I think, is very problematic. And they're making the crisis much longer lasting, much more painful, and much riskier than they need to. But I think to get to the U.S., which is really a very interesting parallel, where there's a lot of brinkmanship going on the U.S. side of the Atlantic. But I think a big difference is that, you know, in the U.S. case, it is pure brinkmanship in that, you know, Greece is bust and Greece will default at some point, I think, whatever. The U.S. is not bust in any meaningful sense. There does not need to be a default in the U.S. in any meaningful manner. It is purely political brinkmanship about the debt ceiling. And so I think it's a very different kind of brinkmanship.
Okay, let's go back to the United States and to brinkmanship. In this debate over increasing the debt limit, the Republicans, of course, have insisted that it all be done with spending cuts, no increase in taxes. During yesterday's news conference, President Obama tried to cast the argument as one between the rich and those who need government services.
And if we choose to keep those tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, if we choose to keep a tax break for corporate jet owners, if we choose to keep tax breaks for oil and gas companies that are making hundreds of billions of dollars, then that means we've got to cut some kids off from getting a college scholarship. That means we've got to stop funding certain grants for medical research.
Okay. Want to update our audience on a couple of things. First of all, the White House refused an invitation from Republican senators to go down to Capitol Hill and talk about all of this, saying it wasn't worth it because they already know what the Republicans think. They don't want to have any taxes. We've been joined by Ron Fournier, who is editor-in-chief of the National Journal. And, Ron, it's good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What does this say about the degree of brinksmanship, political brinksmanship, that we're seeing right now in Washington?
Well, Zinni was exactly right. That's what this is all about. As you know, that the fact of the matter is Congress can easily raise the debt ceiling with no bargaining, no cuts, no tax raises, and no controversy or debate. They've done it in the past, but the Republican Party, you know, for its reasons, has decided to dig in its heels and say, we are not going to go along with raising the debt ceiling, which is basically a procedural matter, unless we get some massive savings out of the government. And what you heard there in the clip just now was the president saying, okay, if that's going to be your position, I'm coming back, but I'm basically going to call you lazy fat cats. I'm going to use the bully pulpit to say that you side with corporate jet setters over kids, and you're too lazy to stay in session and get the people's work done. Well, he literally said yesterday, I'm here take it on bin Laden, and you guys are going off and taking a summer vacation. And you saw today the Senate Majority Leader saying that the Senate will be in session next week.
They're going to shorten the 4th of July vacation instead of taking, well, whatever it was, an entire week. They will be back.
Talking about brinksmanship, chances are they'll be twiddling their thumbs all week just for the perception that they're getting something done.
Let me go back to Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Is it possible that the U.S. might default on its debt, or that investors might, even before August 2nd, come to be so concerned about the United States that they would back away?
I personally do not believe that there is an actual chance that the U.S. will default. But the very thing that we're debating this issue at this moment in the way we are suggests that we have moved beyond, shall we say, business as usual. The sheer uncertainty associated with this runs the risk of almost creating sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. In the sense that as market participants, you know, rationally begin to provision for the unthinkable, well, then you might actually start to see adverse economic effects from this. You might see less liquidity in some markets, interest rates going up, and other things. And this is happening before the actual deadline on August 2nd. And you may also even get a situation where the credit rating agency says that, look, this is so irresponsible of allowing this to go so close to the wire that we're sort of going to have a kind of a preemptively downgrade the U.S., not to obviously to junk or anything like Greece, but we're just going to say that the U.S. is no longer a AAA-rated country. And that as well would have very dramatic implications for the way financial markets work. So we really are playing with fire here.
So back to the politics, Ron Fournier, the Speaker of the House. Mr. Boehner has said he thinks the August 2nd date is artificial. Michelle Bachmann, the Republican candidate for president, Congresswoman from Minnesota, says that she thinks the government couldn't default on its debt. The Treasury Secretary could pay the interest on the debt first. She's got some formula that she has applied. So to what extent do politics mitigate against doing what the rest of the world thinks is necessary and putting at risk this special safe haven?
Now, there's procrastination and minimalist compromise is not a European trait alone. The U.S. government is very good at waiting to the last minute and waiting till it creates its own crisis before the political pressures push forward a compromise, and usually as little as possible that has to get done is what gets done. And I suspect that's what's going to happen here as we creep up to that beginning of August deadline. As has already been said, we're going to see the market starting to panic. We're going to see interest rates start to move up. We're going to see people in Washington realizing that, you know, this isn't just games anymore, that this is going to – it's starting to tick off my constituents. It's starting to have a real effect, and I think that will concentrate the mind. And as we've had in the past, and most recently with the government shutdown, the threat of a government shutdown, although this is much bigger, it's a model for what's likely going to happen, that at the end of the day, when both sides have shown that they've hung in as long as they could and have convinced their constituencies as much as they possibly can that they fought, that there'll be a compromise, there'll be some new austerity measures. It probably the big issues will probably be kicked down the road as much as possible. Because that's for better or worse, that's usually how Washington works.
So, as Annie Minton Beddoes, does this look familiar to you? This waiting until the last minute and politics having to ultimately be determined by some crisis?
Yeah, it's a familiar story, and it happens. You know, it happens often in political negotiations. But what strikes me this year at this point in time is that we have on both sides of the Atlantic really extreme forms of brinkmanship with potentially catastrophic consequences. And that kind of brinkmanship, I think, is quite scary.
We're going to leave it at that. Annie Minton Beddoes with The Economist, economics editor. Thanks to you. Thanks to Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, where he is an economist and research fellow. Ron Fournier, editor-in-chief of the National Journal, and our earlier guest, Nick Malkoutsis, with Katimerini, the Greek newspaper, English edition of the Greek newspaper. Thanks all of you very much for being with us today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. The producers of Which Way LA are Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, and Sonia Geis, supervising producer Gary Scott, managing producer Karen Radziner, technical director Phil Richards. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/WhichWayLA or join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.